Talk given Saturday, 30th January 1971. You all know the word yoga. Some of you go to yoga classes. And by and large, the general activity which goes on is in the practice of various postures of the body. Too many people do this because it will improve their health. And that is one of the interesting baits that is thrown out by the teachers of the practice of postures. Too many people have little idea of what yoga means, and they confine their conception of yoga to bodily postures, more or less. In order to understand yoga, one must really go into the Upanishads. It is from there that all that has been said and taught about yoga is derived. What is the meaning of the word itself? Its root is yuj, meaning in the ordinary physical sense, to yoke, when you yoke oxen to the cart. In the spiritual sense, it is the joining together of that which got separated. And that which got separated is only in my awareness. Because my awareness of my existence and of the world is isolatively self-conscious. Therefore, I am cut off in my consciousness from the one total reality. It is the restoration, the healing, the restoration to the one total reality in full consciousness, which is the objective of yoga. The becoming whole again, not the divided. For in this divisiveness, with its associated ignorance and folly and greed and violence and all the rest of it, in this divisiveness is the state of sin, the broken up state. And it's the restoration of that fundamental harmony of the one total reality, which yoga has as its goal. Yoga, whether you name it Hatha Yoga, Mantra Yoga, Laya Yoga, or any of the other different yogas, Raja, Bhakti, Jnana, Karma, whatever it is, see. All these different names are for the one and only yoga. Which has eight main divisions to it, 8 main aspects to it. And the different names are present, or are given, simply because one, the emphasis is greater in the one case on such and such an aspect of yoga, and in the other case of such and such an aspect. That is all. Yoga is one. It is a one-making. A one-making not in the sense of producing a characterless uniformity, but in releasing a unity whose marvel is the fact that it is made up of a multitudinous variety, each particular being utterly unique in complete relationship to every other particular. See, one has to be careful that one isn't caught up with the words. If one can, as the words are spoken, or when you brood over them, really get the feel of this wholeness, if you get the feel of the wholeness, you will also see to what an extraordinary, tragic extent that wholeness has been split up, broken asunder. When we talk of self-expression, for instance, what is our concept of self-expression? To emphasize difference from the other. And how does one emphasize the difference? By ways and means which exemplify love, wisdom, truth, beauty, goodness, or by ways and means which eat like a cancer into the one living body of man. And what is this self that I am trying to express? This illusory picture in my imagination, not the reality which is here, the living thing, which is continuously changing, continuously trying to grow, to come to fruition into the full likeness of that perfection which alone can be named man. Now, the Upanishads, all of them agree on this. There is no discordant note on this matter. The Upanishads present the 8 aspects thus. Yama, or what is called forbearance or mortification. Niyama, which means religious observances. Then comes posture, the asanas. Then comes pranayama, the control of the breath. Then comes pratyahara, the withdrawal of attention from the objects of sense. One has to be careful how one understands that withdrawal. It is not an escapism, it is not a running away from the world. But instead, if instead of the word withdrawal, because that's the usual translation given, If we look at it this way, I think we will get a better idea. It is to keep free of any domination by the objects of sense and sense perceptions. Keep free of domination by them. Domination over our understanding and our awareness of the actual fact of existence. That's pratyahara. Then comes dharana, which is derived from dhri, meaning to uphold. Dharana, to uphold. An upholding of truth, of the actual fact of our universe, of the universe. Then comes dhyana, which I think you all know well enough and understand. Attention. Meditation in the real sense. Paying total and complete attention. That is dhyana. And the eighth is samadhi, which I prefer to translate as perfect communion, not concentration, and certainly not one of the unfortunate presentations of samadhi as concentration which excludes anything whatsoever. Our concentration is an intellectual thing. I am reading a book. I concentrate my attention upon that. What is being concentrated? My intellectual faculties. My life energy functioning purely as intellect. Discriminative mind. Analytical. And subsequently synthetic, in order to get what I call a whole picture. It's not this concentration. This belongs to the realm of ordinary study, as we understand it in the world, of the mastery of a skill, a know-how, a technique, and so on. It is indispensable there. But this samadhi, is not concentration in that sense. It is the total awareness, completely open to the whole reality. This is not concentration in the dictionary sense. But now, the important point is this. Yama and niyama are the essential bases before we go on to asana and pranayama, postures and breathing. Before. Do we appreciate the reason for that? Postures and breathing deal with power. They generate forces. And these forces are forces which intensify whatsoever is already there. What is already here? An apparatus which will stand the inflow and expression of these subtle energies without being harmed or causing harm to others? Obviously not. In most cases. In the majority of cases. So the absolute necessity of the right foundation. The religious observances in our day and age, we can take with a far lighter touch than in past centuries, for many reasons. We won't go into them just at this moment. But the yamas, the forbearances, the mortifications are of fundamental importance. Now the Upanishads present 10. Patanjali presents only 5 in the yoga aphorisms. Now I'll take the whole lot here. Harmlessness, truthfulness, non-covetousness, continence, kindliness, equanimity, patient endurance, firmness of mind. Firmness is not quite the best word. I feel steadiness would be a better word. Steadiness of mind in gain or loss. And to put it in very, very gentle terms, eating in moderation. Actually, mitahara means scanty eating. And the last, cleanliness of body and mind. Those are the indispensable basis before we proceed to play with subtle forces. How many marks can each one of us give ourselves on each of those counts? Harmlessness. We have dealt with a good bit in the past. Truthfulness. Well, we all know what truthfulness is, and we all know exactly when we are not truthful. Non-covetousness. Does this stop on the borderland of not coveting one's neighbor's wife or ox or maidservant or manservant as laid down in Exodus and so forth? Does it stop there? Non-covetousness. Walk down Regent Street or any such place, looking at the shop windows, and see what happens here. Open Country Life magazine and see all those marvelous advertisements about the houses and estates which are going, and see what happens here. Non-covetousness. Read about somebody's fortune. Read the good news with respect to something which has not come to oneself, and see what happens here. You know, living the religious life is for the strong. For those who are cast in a truly heroic mold, otherwise we merely stand on the other side of a very, very strong fence and watch what's going on within. The implications of each of these is tremendous. Continence. My own feeling is that on this question of continence, India has overemphasized sexual continence. The whole of India, just as the monastic orders of Christendom have overemphasized sexual continence. What is true celibacy? When the male and the female within my single being are in harmony with each other, they continuously fecundate each other, ceaselessly, without concupiscence. Then I am in the self-contained state, pure, active, creative. Each one of us is male, female. When that is fully understood, not just with the brain, you must get it right inside your being. When it is fully understood that way, you will find yourself free of the curse of the uprising sexual passion. It will manifest in the right way and at the right time, according to your age, according to the circumstance, and so forth. But you will be free of its devastating influence upon the whole psyche. And you'll know happiness. But the male and the female within ourselves must be in harmony. The man's body, generally speaking, has a female psyche, the anima. And a woman's body has the male psyche, the animus. I think Jung did quite a service there. Each fecundates the other. Each is a container. And it is also the contained. The psyche, in a mysterious way, is a container of the body, and it is also the contained within the body, and vice versa. When you really see this and are aware of it, and it has become sort of second nature to you, then you know your wholeness as a psychophysical being. This is what it means to be a human being. The animal is like that and obeys the laws of its seasons. But there is no intelligent awareness. In man, the same thing has to come about through intelligent awareness. This is the difference. Perhaps one may put it this way, the animal obeys nature's law and therefore is in harmony. Man is himself nature's law. And has to express harmony through resolving the conflicts within himself. Continence, self-containedness. then I am an adult, come to maturity. Otherwise, I remain in the immature state. It takes a very long time to come to maturity. But if you care, if you really care, it will happen. And you must care without laying down conditions that it should happen thus and thus, or at this time or that time, or in this manner or that manner. No. I cannot lay down the laws according to which the world must run. Kindliness, we all understand that. Daya, lovely word. Sounds to me almost, the Sanskrit word, sounds to me almost onomatopoeic. Daya, kindliness. Kindliness in the sense of pity. Pity for suffering. Compassionateness. This pity which is not tainted with any condescension. It's a lovely thing. And if one has that sense of pity, how does one behave and respond to every living thing then? Aren't we pitiless? Look at our whole history. It's marked with cruelty, with horror, with oppression. A good English word for daya, I feel, is ruth. We talk about a ruthless invader. Now, the opposite of ruthless, ruth. This lovely, it's like some gentle substance which is all absorbing, and in the absorbing it purifies and gives back peace and happiness in lieu of what it originally received, pain and sorrow. This is daya, to me. Then we come to equanimity, arjava, equanimity. Not in the same sense as in Buddhism when we have upekkha. That equanimity is something different. It goes right into profound realms of consciousness. But this equanimity is, I believe, equanimity as we practice it in our daily life. Maintaining a balance. Not getting upset at anything and everything. Even more, not getting upset, as far as is humanly possible, when we are battered with the pace of modern life and the noise and the squalor of modern life. Maintain balance. Patient endurance, kshama. Endurance, I believe, in this case, is in the sense of carrying through, to endure, and to endure patiently. Patience has understanding, compassion, all associated with it. This is not that spineless thing, resignation, of the person who can't solve the thing and just, because he feels quite defeated, but still wants to hold on to ego, he resigns himself to it. It's not that. Any real virtue has the power to heal and restore wholeness between the person and the environment. This sort of patient endurance, very few people have. Because this sort of patient endurance is unconditional. You know, in the Dhammapada, the lovely Buddhist text, if I'm not mistaken, somewhere in the middle you come across it. These are the opening words of the particular chapter. Patience is the highest austerity. Forbearance is the highest austerity. Patience and forbearance lead to nirvana. Now, if one like the Buddha said that, it's not something which we can lightly dismiss. Patient endurance. Consider the application of patient endurance in our own lives, in the religious context. We all want results, don't we, for living the religious life. The solution of our problems, peace of mind, a state of a condition of life where we don't get upset anymore, and so forth and so forth. Put it rather crudely, we want all the nice things. Now, relate patient endurance to oneself, in the religious context too. Oh, I will go through anything and everything, all the tests that the teacher sets me and so forth, because at the end I will get so and so. Look, at the end, I shall realize my nothingness. At the end, only the one total reality shall have come to fruition through this living being, and this living being gets nothing for his pains. Now, be religious. And then you'll be truly religious. So, patient endurance. Not because there's going to be the very comfortable pension at the end. Steadiness of mind in gain or loss. Well, I don't need to say much about that. We all understand that sort of thing, or should understand it. The next one, eating in moderation. And the Upanishads usually suggest satisfy only about 3/4 of your hunger. Not more. Well, if you want to succeed in the observance of that suggestion, start with the determination to satisfy not more than half your hunger. Now, eating in moderation. You know, food and drink are extremely important. Is not this, in considerable part, the product of what went in? So is it of no importance as to what goes in? If I eat an apple, in the ordinary way we say, oh, there's the apple, outside oneself. I'm unaware of the living relationship within the one total reality between that apple and this living being. He stretches forth his hand, eats the apple. That apple had no name apart from the general term apple. This fellow is called Firoz. Firoz eats the apple. What's happened to that apple when Firoz has eaten it? Has it become Firoz? This is the point. Has it become Firoz? Then in this body, which is named Firoz, processes go on. A certain amount of assimilation takes place to replace worn-out tissue, etc. And a certain amount of rejection constantly takes place. And the process is continuous. Takes place all the time in some form or other. Solid, liquid, gaseous, and so forth. Now, that which is rejected, what's going to be the name of that? Is it Firoz disbecome? In the first instance, it was the apple become Firoz. And in the second instance, Firoz disbecomes. What is Firoz? A system in which forces interplay all the time, but not a closed system. It is an open system. Inflow, outflow. Now, the efficiency of this system, insofar as it remains a cohesive whole, this is where the word gravitation in connection with Taurus may have meaning. Insofar as this is a cohesive whole, this has to take in what makes it an efficient system. You know that drugs can produce all sorts of effects upon us. And we are aware of that and take cognizance of it because of the obvious and tremendous effect of a drug. We are not so aware of the effect of food and drink, unless the drink be a strong drink, plenty of alcohol or whatever it be. But it has an effect upon the system. Now, since consciousness is associated with this system, constitutes part and parcel of this working system, that consciousness is also bound to be affected. The way it functions is bound to be affected by what I eat and drink. Now there are some who go to the extreme and make a fetish of food and drink. This is also an unbalanced approach. It is also a selfish, egoistic approach. Without making a fetish of it, consider quietly what is best for this system. You know, the Gita, put in a nutshell, wisdom with regard to food. Foods that are wholesome, bland, delicious, easy to digest, should be taken. They are sattvic foods, as they call them. You see? Wholesome. Not all your denatured stuff sold at excessive prices. Wholesome. The whole thing as nature gives it. As mother gives it. The whole thing. Bland. Not overspiced. Those particularly take notice. Not that I always take overspiced food. Very spice them sometimes, but a little bit, but not over much. And to eat and drink in moderation, real moderation. Notice the interplay of greed and eating. Eating is the first origin, or perhaps I should say drinking, because one takes one's mother's milk first, is the first origin of the growth of greed. Notice how the infant sucks its mother's breast with real gusto, real greed. I like it, I want plenty of it. No good telling mitahara to the newborn infant. You see? And through our childhood, this greed for all the pleasant, nice-tasting foods, the exciting foods, grows and grows and grows. But think of its effect. Not the wrong kind of asceticism with respect to food and drink, though. There is definitely a wrong kind of asceticism with regard to it. But the right kind of asceticism. And let me repeat. To relinquish what one sees is unnecessary is true asceticism. Put it aside. You see, this is not necessary. Put it aside. But you must see out of wisdom that it is not necessary. Not because some authority has laid down that, oh, this is not necessary, you ought not to eat this. If eating elephant's foot is necessary, and I read somewhere years ago that The Africans, some of the Africans are very skilled at cooking elephant's foot, and it's very delicious. I've never tasted it, never will. I don't know. But if elephant's foot is necessary, well then you eat elephant's foot. But you have to discover, is it necessary? And also, just, I'm going to say euphemistically, as a minor matter, consider the problem of compassion involved in the choice of food. Out of compassion, what shall I do? Shall I take life or not take life? Your vegetable also has life, yes. You decide for yourself. Cleanliness of body and mind, well, cleanliness of body everyone knows. Cleanliness of mind. I think you all appreciate that. Now, I'll repeat these. Harmlessness, truthfulness, covetousness, continence, ruth, kindliness, equanimity, patient endurance, firmness of mind, or steadiness of mind in gain or loss, eating in moderation, cleanliness of body and mind. This is basic. I'll also just give you a list of the religious observances. These apply to India especially, but a good many of them apply anywhere and everywhere. Austerity, contentment with what comes naturally, and I like to add, and easily. This is something which you might find very profitable to brood over. Contentment with what comes naturally and easily. See how this is related to grasping, to greed, driven by vanity, driven by egoism, status symbols and all the rest of it. The demand for equality because we are Democrats. A hopelessly nonsensical statement. We don't know what democracy means. We think of democracy as a procedure. A mechanical setup. That is why those with almost completely opposed philosophies to our own also shout from the housetops, democracy. And see what happens. And see what is happening in this land, which in the last 1,000 years, well, a little bit less, but since Magna Carta anyway, in the last 7 or 8 centuries, has been the fount of modern democracy. See what's happening now. Especially in terms of the breakdown of the rule of law. The destruction of good social values and so forth. But if one is content with what comes naturally and easily, many a discord between man and man would not emerge. The next one is, this of course applies to India, belief in the merits or demerits of actions as stated in the Vedas. The next one is a universal thing, dana, charity. Giving gifts to deserving persons, the Shandilya Upanishad specifies. But I think the Buddha or a teacher like Jesus would suggest, just give. Let not thy right hand know, left hand know what thy right hand giveth, and so forth. Dana, gifts, the giving of gifts. Not withholding anything for oneself. It's very difficult to be charitable. Even physically. But to be charitable in mind, what would happen to the bulk of drawing room conversations if people didn't gossip about Mrs. So-and-so or Mr. So-and-so? Is it not as if the bulk of human beings had some sort of vestigial scorpion's tail? Charity. Then Ishvara Pujana, worship of God. Worship, perhaps a better English word might be adoration. Pujana. We say paying homage. That's how it is translated in the Buddhist sense. Paying homage. Puja. But I think adoration might be one of the best words there. Then hearing expositions of the scriptures. They of course have Vedanta. The next one has universal application. Shame at contravening social and, they say Vedic of course, scriptural rules. But it seems that in the name of democracy or socialism or whatever ism we support, we think it our duty to contravene social rules. But these social rules are simply the rules of considerateness for others, essentially. Then, faith in the paths laid down by the scriptures. The next one, japa, mantric recitation, audible and silent. The repetition of mantras. Be careful about this. With the repetition of the mantra, one can just anesthetize the mind. One can hypnotize oneself. One can release forces which one can't control. And they function in ways which we don't see and know. Unless the yamas are there in perfection, there are difficulties attached to this repetition of the mantra. And the tenth, observance of enjoined actions and abstention from prohibited actions. Now you'll notice that these religious observances, as they are called, again, are rather characteristic of the monastic orders in the world. Catholicism, if I'm not mistaken, calls these religious observances of this type the external instruments of grace. My own feeling is that in our day and age, apart from austerity, contentment, charity, a shame at contravening social and religious rules, apart from those, they are outdated. The age is such that we don't need this kind of thing. There's no urgent need about them. If you feel happy with them, all right, be happy. But the yamas, the forbearances and mortifications, are of fundamental importance. Before one goes on to posture and breathing. Let me read just two or three sentences from one of the Yoga Upanishads, which deals with breathing. We all take these things literally. We learn yogic breathing, we say, when we put our finger on one nostril, breathe in through that nostril, breathe out, you see, and then the other nostril and so forth, and count so many in the process. And then we go on to the stage of holding our breath and so forth. And the texts say, finally, you can hold your breath for a whole muhurta, 48 minutes. Can you? And if you can, so what? You've performed an extraordinary feat. You go to a circus, you will see extraordinary feats being performed. There is, at the back of this, a belief in magic, in the sense that you can compel power to serve you. Do you think that yoga is the only thing or the most important thing that knows about breathing? All over the world we do know quite a lot about breathing, as far as physical breathing is concerned. But now, see what the Varaha Upanishad says about breathing. Having talked about all these physical aspects and so forth, which are very difficult to grasp sometimes, here is the important thing. The relinquishing of all external objects, possessions, and so forth, is expiration, out-breathing, rechak. The taking in of spiritual knowledge from the scriptures is puraka, inspiration. And now, this very mysterious holding the breath for impossible to believe periods, and the keeping of such knowledge is said to be restraint of breath. So when you, and similarly in relation to postures, postures do all sorts of things. They certainly give you remarkable control over the body, quite remarkable control. They are also very useful for health. Although sometimes you can tie yourself up in such knots that they become slightly uncomfortable. And they are also useful, very useful, for teaching the body to be calm and quiet. Really calm and quiet, without straining to be calm and quiet. That tension is out. They also help very much in bringing the body to into such a state of harmony that the body no longer interferes with meditation, real meditation. This is, I believe, one of the fundamental purposes of the postures. Now this, bringing the body to a state of calm. I just want to say a few words on that. I can't quite remember, but I think I did say it in one of the Saturday groups. This body, the living physical body, is the repository of energy. Not only energy as the scientist knows it, the energy which he can measure, electrical energy, heat energy, light energy, chemical energy, whatever it is, not only in that sense, but also in the archetypal sense, akashic energy. The energy of the transcendent itself is embodied, and that is why there's the appearance of a physical body. Now, when the body becomes quiet and is not restive, and it is in a state of harmony, its sensitivity to respond to archetypal energy is at its highest. This is not a thing to play with. Because the energy of transcendence, an energy which comes through by meditation, real meditation, intensifies everything that is here. When the body gets completely calm and quiet, it is not merely the physical body that is calm and quiet. The whole psychophysical organism is calm and quiet. The whole psychophysical organism is the final manifestation of the unmanifest. Non-being flows, the one non-being flows into multitudinous beings. The variety comes into existence. The one becomes the many. Now, whenever any one of the many us human beings, for example, is in a state of complete peace and quiet psychophysically, we are now tuned on the wavelength, shall I say, with this universal energy. Can I take 30 million volts? But if one is quiet in that sense, even for a fraction of a second, one knows how creation takes place. Not knows with the brain. You can't give a written description of it. The realm of words just doesn't apply there. But you suddenly realize, this is how it happens. And having said this is how it happens, you're none the wiser up here in the brain. When the Upanishads stated, Brahman or Atma becomes this all, they stated something so profound and deep that it has defeated scholarship through the centuries. Completely defeated scholarship. This mystery of creation. This astonishing mystery of how there is anything at all. How does it subsist? We think we know. We give explanations. A little more knowledge, and we give new explanations. And so that goes on forever and ever. Ending nowhere. But when awareness is totally liberated, as it is said in the Heart Sutra, gone beyond, altogether beyond, not merely the beyond. Merely the beyond is non-being, but altogether beyond is the totally unspeakable. When that happens, you experience creation. And then the result with you is that your whole attitude, your whole stance towards all existence is completely changed. There are no closed doors or windows. You are an open vessel. The utterly purified one. You then know for the first time the real meaning of that word omnipotence. To us, power means only energy like electrical or whatever it is. But this energy is something utterly different. And one gets a glimpse, just a glimpse, of what it means to have grown out of the beast man state in which I am at present into the true man, the whole man. So you see, to keep the body quiet and to make the body non-obstructive through the postures has all these things involved in it. Play with fire if you like, as so many do, particularly on November 5th. But don't complain afterwards. Let there be the basis of purity and mindfulness. And then there'll be real yoga.